I worked for a major press team handling leaks from powerful figures. My role was simple: pass on sensitive information without asking questions. I accepted the job, knowing the risks and the rewards. Every day, I worked with secrets that could shatter lives. I kept a low profile and never drew attention to myself. My work was dangerous but straightforward. I did what needed to be done and made sure nothing could tie me to the leaks. I maintained strict control over every detail. One assignment, however, set everything in motion. A leak I sent out raised more than just eyebrows. I didn't expect repercussions from someone who had everything to lose. My life was about to change in a way I could not control. I soon discovered that in this game, information is power, and crossing the wrong people can be deadly. My decision to leak information had consequences I had never imagined. It was a line I had crossed without knowing the cost. It started with small signs that I was being followed. I noticed a large man in a dark coat appearing wherever I went. I brushed it off at first, thinking it was a coincidence, but the encounters became too regular to ignore. My devices began malfunctioning at odd times. My phone would freeze and my internet connection became unreliable. I wondered if someone was tampering with my equipment deliberately. The pattern was clear. Someone was tracking me. The unease grew when I began to see the man outside my apartment building. He stood a few paces away, watching me without a word. His presence was unsettling. It felt like he was waiting for the right moment to act. Every step I took seemed calculated. I started to fear that my every move was being monitored. The pressure built up, and I knew something dangerous was coming. I had no idea who was behind it, but I suspected it had to do with my leaks. One night after work, my phone rang with no message on the other end. I left the call and hurried home. Outside, I saw the large man standing by a parked car. His stillness made me realize he was not just a passerby. The next day, while on a quick errand, I caught sight of him again, leaning against the wall. His eyes were fixed on me, and I felt an immediate sense of threat. I quickened my pace and avoided looking back. My heart pounded as I tried to shake off the feeling of being hunted. That evening, I was leaving my office when I saw him in a doorway. There was no sign of aggression, just a silent promise that I was being watched. I started to notice him everywhere, outside coffee shops, on quiet streets, even near my apartment. His constant presence left little room for escape. I realized that my life had become a game of cat and mouse. Every routine activity now carried an undercurrent of terror. The man was always there, a silent threat lurking in the background, waiting to pounce. I received an invitation to appear on a television program. The interview was scheduled for Monday, and I prepared despite my rising anxiety. The day before the show, I visited my girlfriend's family for a brief respite. Their warmth was a temporary shield from the looming danger. That night, while watching TV with them, the lights went out abruptly. I fumbled for my phone to use as a flashlight when a heavy thud came from outside. I looked through the window and saw the man stomping across the yard. His heavy steps left no doubt. He was not here by chance. A crash in the front yard drew me outside. I saw him up close for the first time. A hulking figure with an unyielding gaze. In one swift move, he struck one of my girlfriend's brothers, sending him sprawling. The violence was sudden and shocking, a clear message that I was next. I barely had time to process the attack before the man advanced toward me. His movements were measured and ruthless. I knew then that this was not a random act, but a planned assault. Inside of the house, chaos erupted. I raced through the hall while the man pursued me relentlessly. My girlfriend and her mother tried to block his path, but he was determined. In a single moment, he grabbed me and slammed me against the wall, knocking the wind out of me. He then kicked me hard in the leg, and I heard a sickening crack. Pain exploded through my body as I fell to the floor. I struggled to stand while he loomed over me. The brutality of his attack was undeniable and left me reeling. He reached for me again, and I felt his hand tighten around my neck. I fought to break free while Laura's mother and my girlfriend tried to hold him back. Every detail of the encounter was raw and unfiltered. The sound of the impact, the feel of his grip, and the desperate shouts around me. In that moment, my body screamed in protest, yet I managed to cling to a sliver of hope. I wasn't going to give in without a fight, even as the man's strength overpowered me. The situation had spiraled out of control, leaving me with little choice but to endure. Just as I thought I would lose consciousness, Laura's mother intervened. She stood firm, weapon in hand. A service firearm she had trained with. She aimed directly at the attacker, and he hesitated. The sudden shift in power was immediate and final. The man's grip slackened as sirens began to echo in the distance. Within minutes, officers arrived and restrained him. He put up no fight as they cuffed him and took him away. The violent threat was finally neutralized, and a dangerous silence fell over the house. In the chaos, I was helped to my feet despite the pain in my leg. The police took control of the scene, and I realized that my actions had set off a chain reaction that led here. I knew the attack was linked to the leaks I had sent to the press, and a powerful figure was responsible. Later, I learned that P. Diddy had been behind the orchestrated move. His message was clear. He did not tolerate betrayal, even if his part in it was minor. I accepted that my life had changed forever because of my choices. I never appeared on that TV program. The aftermath of the assault taught me that some secrets are best kept hidden. I withdrew from the public eye, burdened by the cost of my actions. I learned to live with a constant reminder of the danger that lurked behind every decision. The incident left a mark on my life, and every day I remembered the relentless threat that had haunted me. I moved away from high-profile assignments and stayed under the radar. The attack had reshaped my world, and I knew it was a line I should never cross again. I now tell this story to warn anyone tempted by the lure of forbidden information. Power plays have a way of catching up with you when you least expect it. My experience is a reminder that betrayal, even against a minor player, can unleash unforeseen horrors. Even though the violence is over, its memory remains. I live each day with a cautious awareness of the past, knowing that some enemies never truly disappear. The price of truth is steep, and my life will always carry the scars of that night.
I work as a janitor at a high-end hotel. My job was to clean rooms and keep everything in order. I followed a strict routine and never expected that one night everything would change. I had been doing my work for years without any sign of trouble. That evening, I was assigned to a floor I rarely visited. No one mentioned that the floor was under a special lease. I simply received my schedule and my cleaning card. I was just ready to finish my shift and go home. I trusted that my routine would remain exactly that. I walked the well-lit corridors with purpose. I kept to my schedule, room after room, unaware that tonight was not going to be ordinary. I paid little attention to the silence, thinking only of finishing my tasks quickly. I did not imagine that this shift would be the worst night of my life. I arrived at room 510. A large suite that should have been empty. The door stood slightly open, and I assumed it was a mistake. I pushed the door open and stepped inside, not knowing what awaited me there. I began my work, unaware that I had crossed into a place that I was not meant to be. Inside room 510, I found a group of people in identical robes. They had arranged themselves in a circle in the middle of the room. I saw no guest belongings or signs of a normal hotel occupancy. It was clear this room was not being used for a standard stay. I looked around for any explanation, a misplaced bag, a service note, whatever, but I found nothing. The room was decorated luxuriously, yet its setup was deliberate and unsettling. I realized that I was in a place I was not meant to be. But I didn't have time to analyze the situation. My first instinct was to leave, quietly. I turned to leave the room, planning to report what I saw later. Before I could step out, one of the robed figures advanced. His movement was sharp and forceful, showing that I was not welcome. I tried to back away, but I was already surrounded. They closed in quickly. I was grabbed from behind and forced toward the center of the room. I didn't have time to shout or plead. I understood immediately that I had intruded on something dangerous, and that there would be no simple way out. They grabbed me hard the moment I tried to escape. A rough hand clamped on my shoulder while another pinned my leg to the floor. I was thrown down into the hard surface with no warning. I struggled immediately, but they had me firmly in place. The group began marking my arms and face with crude, deliberate strokes. They drew symbols on my skin with a steady, cold precision. I felt every mark cut into me as I thrashed to free myself. Their actions were methodical and showed no sign of hesitation. I kicked and writhed, trying to break their grip. My efforts only resulted in the men tightening their hold. I didn't hear any words as they worked. Only the sound of my own labored breathing and the noise of my struggles filled the room. I was treated like an object in their plan. I understood immediately that I was being prepared for a sacrifice. There was no time to think about why they had chosen me. I had to fight to escape, even though every moment on the floor brought me closer to an unknown fate. The situation was simple and brutal. I managed to break free from one of the grips in a sudden burst of strength. I kicked one of the men hard and scrambled away from the center of the circle. In that brief moment of confusion, I made a run for the door. My heart pounded as I bolted out of room 510. Once in the corridor, I could hear the shouts behind me. I ran without stopping, knowing that every second counted. I turned down a long hallway, trying to put as much distance between me and that room as possible. The sound of heavy footsteps followed me relentlessly. I reached the staircase and sprinted upward, desperate to lose my pursuers. Every step was a struggle, but I didn't stop. I focused only on escape and not on the pain of each bruise. My only thought was to get out of that hotel alive. I heard a commanding voice ordering my capture, a voice I recognized all too well. It was P. Diddy. His voice cut through the noise as he commanded his followers to catch me at all costs. I did not dare look back, only pushing forward with every ounce of strength that I had in me. I ran through the corridors as I heard P. Diddy's orders echoing behind me. My footsteps pounded on the hard floor while the shouts of his robed followers grew louder. I turned corner after corner, trying to stay ahead of them. I did not plan my escape. I simply ran. At one point, I reached a section of the hotel I knew well from my shifts, but the familiarity offered no comfort. Instead, every door and hallway became a potential trap. I dodged around corners, occasionally glancing behind me to see if they were gaining ground. They did not slow down, and neither could I. I sprinted down a long corridor until someone from the hotel called out to me.
"Hey, where are you going?"
I did not stop to answer. I only ran faster, my heart pounding with the need to survive. Their voices faded as I reached another staircase. The direct orders from P. Diddy still rang in my ears, fueling my urgency. I fought through every obstacle with raw determination. I jumped over a fallen piece of furniture and slid under a low doorway. My body ached from the struggle, but I didn't care. I only wanted to put as much distance as possible between me and those who pursued me. I finally reached a nearly empty floor and ducked into a storage closet. I slammed the door behind me and held my breath, listening for any sign that my pursuers had caught up. The silence in the small room was not safe, but it gave me a moment to catch my breath and plan my next move. After several long hours, I carefully opened the door to check the corridor. It was empty, and I took the chance to slip away quietly. I moved slowly toward the stairwell, checking every shadow for movement. I had to assume that any noise could bring the danger back. I eventually found an exit and left the hotel building. My body was bruised and exhausted,
but I had made it out. I took a taxi to a nearby police station to report what had happened. I explained everything clearly. The cult meeting in room 510, the brutal marking, the chase, and P did his direct orders. I contacted the hotel management to tell them of the events. They listened, but their faces were blank and unhelpful. I realized then that I could no longer trust anyone from that place. I left that hotel and vowed never to return. The next morning, I was urged to return to the hotel to give a full statement to the police. I walked toward the designated interview room, determined to set the record straight. I had documented every detail in my mind and on paper. I was ready to face the consequences of that night. Before I could enter the room, a co-worker intercepted me near the reception desk.
"This is a trap. If you go in there, you won't come out alive."
I paused, confused by his words. This was a friend, and he and I had known each other from long ago. At that moment, I turned around and walked out of the hotel. The manager saw me and asked me from afar,
"Hey, where are you going? Come back. The police are waiting for you."
I did not stop. I turned and ran out of that hotel immediately. I left without looking back, determined to keep away from that place. I never returned to that hotel after that night. I tried to contact my co-worker to thank him, but he was missing. He didn't return home that night either, and nobody has ever seen him again.
I'm Richard, a down-and-out music producer who did everything I could for my family. I worked in cramped studios, hustled at small gigs, and rarely saw the reward for my efforts. My life was simple, no frills, just hard work and a stubborn hope that things could change. Every day was a fight against the odds. My son, Jake, was my only bright spot. He was a good kid with a knack for music and a big dream of making it in the industry. I put every spare cent and ounce of energy into his talent, believing he would someday rise above our struggles. Our home studio was our entire world, and every beat he made felt like progress. We never had fancy nights or grand celebrations, just long hours and a lot of sweat. The music we made was raw, unpolished, and real. There was no room for pretension, just a need to survive and to make our mark. I kept my hope practical and my actions even more so. Everything was straightforward until one message changed our routine. It was a message that promised a shot at something big, something I'd only ever dreamed of for Jake. Jake got a text one day saying that a friend had sent one of his tracks to someone close to P. Diddy. The idea that the hip-hop mogul might take notice was electric. We met the guy in a quick business-like meeting. P. Diddy agreed to sign on as Jake's new producer. It felt like our hard work had finally been validated. I stepped aside, thinking that with a big name behind him, Jake would finally get the attention he deserved. The deal was straightforward. P. Diddy would handle everything from here. At first, it was all excitement and the promise of a new start. Success was on the horizon. Or so it seemed. After that meeting, though, things began to shift. Jake started spending more time away from home. He was always with men in expensive cars or in high-end studios, his schedule filled with meetings and recording sessions. I assumed it was just the nature of the business, but there was something in his eyes that made me uneasy. I noticed small changes, a cold look when he returned and moments when he would stare blankly at kitchen knives. There was no explanation, no outburst, just a disturbing detachment. I was a father watching his son slip away, and I couldn't shake the feeling that this wasn't just stress from success. Jake's behavior grew stranger with each passing day. He became distant, his warm smile replaced by a hard, unresponsive stare. I caught him in the kitchen one afternoon, standing silently in front of our set of knives as if he was studying them. His usual spark was gone, replaced by a quiet, unsettling focus that made it clear he wasn't himself. One evening I found him scribbling on scraps of paper. The drawings were crude and unsettling. Those were symbols that had no place in a teenager's notebook. It wasn't the playful doodling of an aspiring artist. It was deliberate and chilling. I confronted him, but he only shrugged it off with a cold nod and went back to work. I tried to track his routines, noting every odd behavior and unexplained disappearance. Every time he returned, the change in him was more pronounced. The kid I had nurtured was being replaced by someone I barely recognized. I kept thinking that this was just a side effect of the new lifestyle, but deep down, I knew it was something far worse. The normalcy of our small home was crumbling. I watched as Jake's transformation became visible to everyone, and I was powerless to stop it. Each day brought more signs that he was being dragged into a world that had no place for a kid like him. One night, a scream shattered the quiet of our home. My wife and I rushed to Jake's room without a word, and what we saw defied any normal explanation. The walls were crudely marked with satanic symbols, and in the middle of the room, Jake hovered over his younger brother, Luke, who was tied to a chair inside a hastily drawn circle. Jake held a knife with a steady grip. Luke sat there, eyes wide with terror, barely able to breathe. My wife lunged in and grabbed Jake's legs, trying to stop him from moving any further, but he jerked away like a man in a trance, and the knife clattered to the floor with a harsh clang that filled the room. There was no time for subtlety. I rushed forward, determined to stop whatever was happening. The entire scene was raw, aggressive, and impossible to ignore. Every second counted as we scrambled to protect Luke from the unfolding madness. The energy in that room was intense and aggressive. There was no room for hesitation. I grabbed Jake's arm, trying to pull him away, but he fought back with a strength that wasn't his own. That night, our home was transformed from a place of hope into a battleground of raw, unfiltered terror. After that night, everything fell apart. Jake became a ghost in our home, moving with a cold precision that left no trace of the caring son we once knew. He was constantly out, tied up in secret meetings and shadowy deals. The distance between us grew with every passing day, and our conversations turned brief and emotionless. I started following him when I could, trying to catch a glimpse of what he was involved in. One evening, I saw him meeting with a group of sharply dressed men near an abandoned warehouse. Their talk was a mix of music business and something else. Something dark and inexplicable that sent chills down my spine. I listened from the shadows, every word confirming that my son was lost to a dangerous world. The final blow came on a deserted street under a flickering light. I ran into him unexpectedly. He stopped and glared at me with eyes that were hard and unyielding. Without any warning, he charged with a knife. I managed to twist his wrist and knock the weapon aside, but it was clear this was no random act. It was a calculated, violent outburst. That moment sealed it. The Jake I knew was gone. In his place was someone controlled by forces that didn't belong in our world. The confrontation was quick and brutal, leaving me with a painful, clear truth that nothing would be the same again. The next day, Jake was nowhere to be found. Calls to his contacts and even P. Diddy's team went unanswered. My wife and I were left with an empty house and a sinking feeling that we had lost him for good. I followed a trail of hints until I reached a dark alley behind an old building. There, on the cold pavement, lay Jake battered and bleeding. His clothes were torn and he looked like he had been through a relentless assault. I knelt beside him, a mix of anger and desperate concern flooding my senses. There was no time for a detailed explanation, just a need to get him help. Before paramedics could take him away, a cold, mocking laugh echoed in the narrow space. It was a sound that left no doubt. Someone had orchestrated all of this. The person behind Jake's change was still out there, pulling strings and leaving our family to pay the price. I held on to him as the paramedics loaded him into an ambulance. The brutal reality was clear. Our lives had been shattered, and no amount of words can undo the horror that had taken hold of my son. Jake ended up in a mental institution, and our home became a stark reminder of the chaos that took over our lives. There was nothing left to say or explain, only the hard truth of what had happened and a few raw images that played out like a violent scene. The music world moved on, ignoring the trail of destruction behind its powerful figures. No one wanted to talk about that night when ambition and dark influences converged into a brutal act. The incident was swept under the rug, leaving behind a broken family and a father with nothing but regret.
I once came across a saying that went, "The biggest dreams are found and made on the streets of Los Angeles." I used to obsess over this quote in my early 20s as I'd convinced myself that the only way I'd ever achieve my dreams was if I moved to Los Angeles. My obsession with the city of dreams continued to grow over time, and it wasn't long before I eventually caved and moved there to chase my big dreams. Everything was fine at first, but unfortunately, I soon realized how wrong I was, as the only thing I found in LA were horrific nightmares. The tragic tale you're about to hear will explain why. I moved to the city of Los Angeles when I was 23 years old. I can still remember every single detail of that day, as I thought moving there would be the start of a beautiful time in my life. I lived with my childhood friend, a girl named Vicky, and we would always stay up all night talking about our dreams and the things we wanted to accomplish in the city. Vicky was a proper LA girl, as she moved there when she was 9 after her father had gotten a job opportunity in the city. Our mothers were best friends, and we pretty much grew up together as we'd known each other since we were 2. We'd managed to keep in contact over the years, even after she moved, and I remember how ecstatic Vicky was when I told her that I was planning on moving to LA. My first few months in LA went pretty well, as Vicky really helped me to quickly settle in, having lived there for most of her life. I really don't know how I would have survived without her, as she'd integrated me into her friend group and even showed me all the best places to eat and shop. After living with Vicky for a while, I realized that she was pretty well known around her area, as the locals had given her the nickname, the Party Queen. She'd told me that she'd gotten this nickname because she always managed to get invites to the best parties in LA. Her nickname didn't come as a surprise to me, as Vicky loved to party and live her life to the fullest ever since we were little. She also used these parties as a tool to grow her social connections, as Vicky wanted to be an actress when she finished school, and she knew the people she met and the connections she made during these parties could help her achieve her dream of acting. Vicky often took me along whenever she needed a plus one to the parties she'd gotten invited to. I experienced some of the best moments of my life at the LA parties that I attended with Vicky, as we'd always had a great time together. However, while I didn't know it at the time, the parties that I loved going to would eventually lead me to a horrific experience that would scar me for life, and it all began when Vicky managed to get invited to one of the most exclusive parties in Hollywood. I can still recall the excitement on Vicky's face that fateful morning when she told me about the invite. She said she'd moved heaven and earth to get us into the best and most exclusive party of the year. I asked who was hosting the party, and Vicky looked at me with a wide grin on her face as she said the name, Mr. Combs. I was speechless at first, as I couldn't believe the words that had just come out of her mouth. The reputation of these infamous parties hosted by Mr. Sean Combs, who's popularly known as Puff Daddy, preceded them, as everyone knew they were some of the wildest parties ever thrown in LA and across the United States. I didn't know how she got an invite, as it was nearly impossible to get one. But Vicky said it was a friend of a friend who worked for him that managed to get her in. After the excitement of being invited had simmered down, we spent the whole day getting ready for the party that night. I can still recall the smile on Vicky's face as she said, "This is going to be one of the best nights of our lives, and I'm sure it's going to be a Hollywood story that we'll remember forever." The party was held at Mr. Combs' Los Angeles mansion, which was located in the Homely Hills neighborhood on South Mapleton Drive. It started at 9:30 p.m., but Vicky and I had arrived at 10:30 p.m. Before we were allowed to enter, the man at the door told us to hand over our phones, as the taking of any photos or videos without Mr. Combs' consent was prohibited. I didn't see anything wrong with this, as I assumed it was due to the alarming amount of high-profile guests and A-list celebrities that were attending. After we'd given them our phones, we were then given a piece of paper to sign. I didn't know what it was at first, but I soon realized that it was a non-disclosure agreement. Vicky quickly signed hers and asked me to sign mine so we could get inside. But I was a bit hesitant. There were certain details of the NDA that I found strange. particularly the one that said the NDA was in effect for the entire life of the signee plus 20 years after their death. I wondered what could be going on behind those doors that we couldn't talk about for the rest of our lives. I started getting nervous, but Vicky calmed me down, saying that this was just the standard at these types of parties. I knew we couldn't turn back now, and I also knew how hard it was for Vicky to get us invited, so I didn't want to ruin the night for her. The man at the door was already giving me a strange look, and I knew I didn't have much time left to make up my mind. So I put all my fears aside and convinced myself to sign it. Once we signed, we were quickly ushered into the lavish mansion. It all felt surreal, and I couldn't believe I'd made it to a Diddy party after just a few months of living in LA. Only a few minutes had passed before I finally saw Mr. Combs. He walked up to us, and after we exchanged pleasantries, he told us that we weren't meant to be partying with anyone else in the main room, as we were special guests and we were supposed to be in the VIP room. I was confused as I wondered what he meant by special guests. That's when he took us to a secluded room in the mansion, and as he opened the door to usher us in, my heart dropped to my stomach. The room we were told to enter was some sort of BDSM-themed sex dungeon. My mind couldn't handle it all, as some of the most vile, sadistic, and masochistic sexual acts were being performed in every corner of the room. I saw several women hanging naked from the ceiling. Some of them had needles sticking out of their bodies, while others were bleeding while participating in sexual acts. I'd heard about hematoglycinia, or blood play, which is a fetish where people are sexually aroused by blood, but I'd never seen it carried out before, and it horrified me. This was just a fraction of what was going on in that room. The more I look, the worse it got. Several people around the room were participating in even more disturbing sexual acts like scat play, which involved the use of feces, extreme sexual asphyxiation, and electrostimulation, just to name a few. I can't even properly describe some of the extreme scenes I witnessed in that room, as they are far too graphic to repeat. I recognized some of the male and female celebrities who were participating in these extreme sexual acts. There were some of the biggest stars in Hollywood there, but I can't bring myself to mention any of their names. After showing us around, Mr. Combs then proceeded to coerce both me and Vicky to participate in these disturbing sexual acts with several other women. We wanted to leave at that point, but we soon realized that we wouldn't be able to, as Mr. Combs and a few of his celebrity friends were very coercive, and I knew they weren't going to stop until they'd managed to convince us. I remember how Mr. Combs, his eyes bloodshot red from all the drinking, coerced Vicky into participating by saying,
Nah, playgirl, we just getting started, and we won't stop, can't stop. Come on, baby, this is your key into Hollywood, and I know you're not stupid enough to give this up. You don't want to leave now?
This was probably the worst mistake of our lives, but we were young and eventually caved under the pressure. Just like the many other women there, we allowed Mr. Combs and his celebrity friends to have their way with us. I don't know how long it all lasted, but right when I thought it was over, things got much worse. Mr. Combs said he'd saved the best part of the night for last, as he informed everyone that we were about to carry out an exclusive Diddy Party BDSM act called the Piñata. The Piñata was apparently an extreme form of BDSM spanking or impact play. The men were given wooden bats padded with cotton, and a woman who was tied up was then placed in a circle while Combs and his friends violently whacked her around the room using the padded bats as if she were a piñata. They'd managed to get several women to participate in this disturbing act, and unfortunately, one of them was Vicky. Vicky hadn't realized what she'd signed up for, and I can still remember the terror in her eyes when it started. She eventually began to scream, saying she didn't want to do it anymore, but Combs and his friends didn't care.
Dance, bitch, and sing
the
song!
All just kept hitting her around the room.
Yeah!
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
Who got the Johnson & Johnson?
It wasn't long before she couldn't take it anymore, and I watched in horror as Vicky collapsed. I rushed to her side and noticed she wasn't moving. Mr. Combs then told everyone to clear the room, saying he would get her some help. I can never forget how excruciatingly bad I felt as Vicky's motionless body was then taken out through the back because Mr. Combs didn't want to alarm the guests partying upstairs. I tried to go with her as I didn't want to leave her side, but Mr. Combs didn't allow it. He told me he would handle it personally and assured me that Vicky would reach out to me the next day when she was feeling better. But unfortunately, that was the last time I ever saw Vicky alive. When I didn't hear from Vicky the next day, I endlessly tried reaching out to Mr. Combs to find out what happened to my friend, but he never gave me a straightforward answer. Not long after, Vicky's family started calling and asking about her whereabouts. At this point, I told Mr. Combs that I'd have to tell her family and the police the truth, but he reminded me of the NDA I signed and threatened me with violence and imprisonment for defamation if I ever talked. Mr. Combs told me to tell Vicky's family that she'd run away and skipped town, or else the same thing that happened to her would happen to me. Lying to Vicky's family was the worst thing I'd ever done in my life, but I was completely terrified and knew I had no choice. Vicky's family eventually reported her as a missing person when they never heard back from her, but despite several efforts from the authorities, the police were never able to find her. The story you just heard was anonymously shared by a woman using the alias Catherine. Numerous efforts made by the authorities to uncover the woman's real identity and to verify these claims have proved fruitless, as there was no possible way of tracing the tragic story back to her. With the many recent atrocities that have surfaced against Mr. Sean John Combs, widely known as Puff Daddy or P. Diddy, the authorities are currently trying to uncover the entire truth behind the unspeakable acts that took place at Mr. Combs' freak-off parties, in addition to his white parties. Investigators believe they have only just scratched the surface of the horrors Mr. Combs committed at these events, and they hope to bring justice to all affected parties at the end of the investigation.